Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Billboard Sharpie Podcast. Harry Chess, Billboard Senior Director of Charts.
And hey guys, it's Trevor Anderson, a chart manager here at Billboard.
Joined this week by
a senior editor, Andrew Unterberger, Digital Side.
Big week on the Hot 100 with Billie Eilish taking over after 19 weeks of the record for Old Town Road. So we're going to talk so much about that this week. And also going to flash back at the end of the podcast, 40 years to the number one song with Dave and Yael Penn from Hit Songs Deconstructed coming back on the podcast, talking about how that number one song. It's actually, you can hear traces of it in a lot of current hits and through the years, many other hits. So I'll talk about what that song is coming up at the end of the podcast. But as always, starting with the top 10 on this week's Billboard Hot 100 with, a new number one.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Number 10.
Can't write one song that's not about you. Can't drink without thinking about you. Is it too late to tell you that everything means nothing if I can't have you? I can't write one song that's not about you.
Number 9.
I want you out of my head. I want you out of my bedroom tonight. There's no way I can save you. Cause I need to be safe too. I'm no good at goodbyes. We're both acting insane.
Number 8.
I got red, I got blue, what you want? The Chanel, Balenciaga, Louis Vuitton. She know I got the Fanny Prada when I am alone. I needed me a Diorada, I need me the one. I started from the bottom, you can see the way.
Number 7.
Cause I don't care when I'm with my baby, yeah. All the bad things disappear. You're making me feel that maybe I am somebody.
Number 6.
Ain't never got you know it being modest. Poppin' ship it only cause you know you poppin', yeah. You got it, girl, you got it. Hey. You got it, girl, you got it.
Number 5.
Can we just talk? Can we just talk about where we're going before we get lost?
Number 4.
Fresh photos with the bomb lighting. New man on the Minnesota Vikings. True hearts needed something more exciting. Bum, bum, be dum, be dum.
Number 3.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more.
I got the horses in the bag. Stock is a
time. Number 2.
I love it when you call me senorita. I wish I could pretend I didn't need ya. But every touch is ooh la la la. It's true la la la. Ooh, I should be running. Ooh, you know I love it when you call.
And number 1.
I'm that bad type. Make your mama sad type. Make your girlfriend mad type. Might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy.
There it is, new number one. That is the song Bad Guy. The artist named Billie Eilish. So, yeah, for the first time since middle of April, we can talk about a new number one on the Hot 100. Feels like, I don't know. I mean, I guess for some people, it feels like their long national nightmare is over. For some others, I know people actually were really sad to see it go, even though it already has the record. You know, people just kind of wanted this to go on maybe forever, it felt like.
I don't think that many people necessarily considered it a nightmare, but I think everybody sort of agrees at this point. It's just time to wake up. You know, it was a nice dream, but it lasted maybe a little bit longer than some of us are comfortable with. I mean, we're feeling kind of groggy at the end of it. Time to get up and start the day and start a new chapter.
All right, so there's a lot we can talk about with the song being number one. I'll start with a song written by Billie and her brother Phineas, produced solely by Phineas. Feels like a bit of an underdog story.
I suppose, unless you were Andrew Unterberger, no one saw Lil Nas X coming. Fine, if you say you did, you lie. But Billie Eilish has been, I feel like, on this kid's radar for a minute.
I'm this kid now? Is that what's going on here? All right, I have been predicting big things for young Billie for a little while now, probably going back like a year or two. But this is bigger than I would have expected. I think we all sort of knew that she was going to do big numbers with her album. When we all see Where Do We Go, by that point, she had kind of put up the streaming numbers to prove that she had a pretty sizable fan base, and you could also see that on her social accounts and just sort of the enthusiasm around her whenever she made a public appearance, or whenever you saw videos of her on tour, her playing festivals. Certainly, it seemed like this was going to be a pretty huge year for her, regardless. I don't think anybody necessarily saw Bad Guy specifically becoming her first number one hit. I would have thought, okay, this album kind of lays the groundwork. And it actually debuted the same week that Old Town Road hit number one for the first time. But I thought that's a big debut. And obviously, you know, it was the first full track on the album. So that helped the streaming totals. And that was probably a big part of why it had that big debut. And it had a really catchy video that went along with it. But I don't think... a lot of people, and I certainly didn't expect it to really grow from there. It slid back on the Hot 100 in the weeks after that, and then kind of boomeranged. And then for the last two or three months, we've been seeing it kind of slowly inch its way up to the top five, and then stick at number two for a really long time. That, I think, would have been a totally reasonable outcome for that song. It's not like a very traditional pop song, not like any of the songs we're talking about these days really are, but. You know, yeah, as you're saying, it's a weird song from a pretty underground artist and sort of coming from humble beginnings. And, you know, as this mid-song beat drop, and it doesn't really fit naturally on any one radio format. So it ends up sort of fitting unnaturally on all of them. There's a lot that goes into it. But, yeah, it's a pretty unconventional number one. It's a worthy successor to Old Town Road. And it sort of shows where we are right now, pop music.
Do you remember when you first listened to the album, what your reaction was to the song? And I say that partly because Bury a Friend was the first alternative single, and that pop, Interscope went with When the Party's Over first. It wasn't even the first single in either format.
Yeah, I don't think it's the obvious choice necessarily off the album. I mean, you talk about it being the first full song on the album, so it certainly, you know, caught a lot of listeners that way. And, you know, the chorus is certainly very catchy and fun, and there's the duh that sort of, you know, kind of serves as the centerpiece for the song. And, you know, there's a lot to kind of latch onto with it. It's a really, really memorable song in a lot of ways. Would I have thought that this was going to be the song that you know, puts her in league with, you know, that gets her where, you know, Taylor and Shawn Mendes and Post Malone weren't able to get this year, getting stuck behind Lil Nas X when she's able to get over the top finally? I certainly wouldn't have predicted that. But, again, this is sort of the new normal of 2019. You know, the conventional ballad isn't necessarily the obvious choice. Even a song like Bury a Friend, which is maybe, a little bit more conventionally structured, at least it doesn't have a complete dissolve halfway through that turns it into a different song entirely. That's not necessarily a more obvious pick either. I think that the obvious pick these days is the song that everybody latches onto from the album, and that was Bad Guy, and so here we are.
So, Andrew, you oversee the 5 Burning Questions post that we do every week about something major going on in the charts. This week, it's obviously Billie Eilish.
More major than this?
I feel like I have to ask you about 2 answers you had.
Let's have it.
In that. So the first one is you said that you wouldn't have minded, or at least you thought maybe sometimes an artist has to pay their dues a little bit more before getting that first number one, because it looked like maybe Bad Guy was going to peak at number two. And you said, you know, that's not always the worst thing, because it gives you something to shoot for afterwards.
Yeah, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, she has to pay her dues as if like she hasn't earned the number one. She certainly has. She's built up her fan base in a really interesting and organic way. And she certainly is, you know, one of the defining pop stars of this moment this year. And Bad Guy is one of the biggest hits of this year by pretty much any conventional stretch, or any conventional definition, rather. So it's not like the song's an unworthy number one. I don't think it should be punished for being early in her career. But yeah, from a, you know, sentimental viewpoint, as a chart watcher, I do kind of like the arcs of pop stars' careers where they have to sort of keep reaching new plateaus and kind of get incrementally closer to the number one without just kind of arriving there immediately. And, you know, as I mentioned in my answer in the column, you can see it with a number of the pop stars that we consider probably some of the biggest of the decade, where artists like Drake and Taylor Swift and now Shawn Mendes and a couple other really, really big names, Justin Bieber, Ariana Grande, who all had a number two hit that kind of, you know, you thought maybe it would get to number one, maybe it wouldn't, but it tapped out at number two. And then they had to wait a little bit. They had to keep trying, and eventually they got to number one. And then once they did, the floodgates opened, and then they all had multiple number ones after that. But yeah, it feels more rewarding, I think. You know, I'm sure the artist would rather get it as soon as possible, but for a fan base, I think it feels more rewarding that they have to kind of work for it, and that they have to, you know, that they get the number two before they get to the number one. It's like getting nominated for an Oscar before you win. It just makes that final breakthrough all the more satisfying.
Being a Red Sox fan, the way can be that much sweeter when you finally win.
You take the number ones where you can get them.
Yeah.
I'm sure Billie Eilish is not saying, I would have felt better if I got it a couple years later. I'm sure she's more than happy with her number one achievement. And I'm sorry if I'm stepping over your next question here, but I also want to point out that Billie was 1 week away from making history with this particular number two.
Yeah, that was the other answer you gave that I feel like is sort of a controversial but a different take, is that did I read this right? You actually said that you think it would have been cooler in some ways for it to have tied the record for most weeks, peaking at number two, never get to number one, get those 10 weeks or maybe more, set the record. You think there's in some ways that's better than hitting number one?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's better from an historical viewpoint. I'm sure that her publicist would rather be able to say, you know, we've got a number one, then yeah, we had a 10-week number two. But as a chart obsessive, as somebody who's, you know, been relatively infatuated with Hot 100 minutia since far before I started working here, you know, that's a sacred mark to me, that 10-week number two. You know, Foreigner's Waiting for a Girl Like You and Missy Elliott's Work It. Can't think of two very much more different songs than that to hit number two, but I love both of those songs an incredible amount. I think it's extremely esteemed company to keep, and I think there is something to be said for like the historic runner up. I think that gets you into the record books just the same. It makes you part of Billboard lore, makes you part of Hot 100 history. I certainly will never forget those songs, and I wouldn't have forgotten Bad Guy either if it had made that mark. And yeah, I mean, it's a cool little sort of footnote to have in a career that's probably going to go on to do some pretty tremendous things at the top of the charts from here. You know, 10-week number two, that's a thing that not a lot of other songs get to claim. So I think we're sort of overlooking the specialness of that record just because it does, you know, it is still a silver medal. It is still a runner-up position.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, but ultimately it's kind of a bittersweet mark.
I'd
rather have just the sweet mark.
Billie, she'll get other cracks. She'll have her shot to get to number one probably multiple times if she's so inclined. So I think getting this mark out of the way early, I think that would have been fun from a chart-watching perspective.
I mean, but that is, you know, sort of a dangerous take, I guess, just because, I don't know, I feel like when Missy Elliott was number two for 10 weeks, you look at Work It, and, you know, I mean, as major as that song was, and, you know, if you probably ask people, you know, was it number one, they probably would just feel like, yeah, it was. But I'm sure many people thought, oh, yeah, okay, Missy's, you know, she's on this hot streak, this is her best album under construction, Work It's, you know, even she already had plenty of hit singles, but that was sort of, you know, a next level up. So, yeah, I'm sure Missy will come back with that number one soon. And, you know, it never happened. And I just feel like, obviously, you know, there's other factors working in Billie Eilish's corner that, yes, I think set her up for, you know, her potential number ones, and Foreigner got their number one. But just to, you know, I mean, just for someone like Missy to be like, you know, okay, well, then we'll take the number two record and we'll go back and get it. You never get that number one.
Never
it's never
know.
Guaranteed. And, you know, Missy herself said that, you know, those 10 weeks were like the most agonizing weeks of her life. So I guess for the artist, as much as the publicist, it feels like there's not really a whole lot of joy in just every week, you know, waiting to see how am I still number two?
Obviously, you're right. And Missy, by that point, she was a good half decade into her career at that point, and she had come close before, close-ish at least. She had had top 10 hits. She had been in the mix before, so I imagine she wasn't feeling as charitable with the if she'd been stuck for 10 weeks behind Lil Nas X, as you say, it would have been excruciating for her, and I'm sure she would have been more than happy to get over the hump there. But for Billie, she's still 17 years old. She's the youngest person this decade, or the youngest since Lord, I guess, since to have a number one, first person to be born in the 2000s to have a number one hit. Clearly she's got a pretty long career ahead of her. Now, it's possible this would have been as close as she got, and then maybe she would have looked back and been like, damn, that little Nas X just couldn't give me 1 week.
If the Sixers lose, say, a record 5 finals in a row, I'm going to ask you how you feel about that.
I think they did do that, and in the late 70s and early 80s, they lost 4 out of 5, and then they finally won in 83. And I bet you that the 83 championship was a lot sweeter based on those times that they came so close and didn't quite get there.
And we'll never be
You mentioned Lord. So many obvious, easy top-level comparisons to make. Billie is the youngest artist since Lord to be number one on the Hot 100. Also the first alternative songs number one, Bad Guy, since Royals. So are those fair comparisons? We were maybe in some ways having a lot of these same discussions about Lord back in 2013. How do you look at those two artists?
Well, it's a little bit different, I think, because nobody knew anything about Lord unless you're from the land down under. The greater New Zealand area. I don't think that anybody really had much awareness of Lord before Royals started making tracks and getting close to the Hot 100 and eventually topping it. But Billie Eilish, I mean, this sort of feels like the culmination, doesn't it? I mean, like we were talking about Billie in here before this song even existed. We were talking about her for Bury Your Friend and to a lesser extent, You Should See Me in a Crown and When the Party's Over and other songs that already made her a pretty public presence, if not necessarily like a radio conqueror the way this song is turning out to be. But, even on the alternative songs chart, this isn't her first number one. Bury Your Friend already gone to number one. And so it feels a little bit different because it doesn't feel like this is the song that's going to define her. It feels like Billie Eilish is already too big to be defined by any one song, whereas that was definitely a risk with Lord. I mean, she sort of got out of that box because she had another top 10 hit. She got nominated for an Album of the Year Grammy. At this point, Lord is Lord, and people associate with her with Royals forever. It's the one song by her that everybody knows. But there are Lord fans that don't care about Royals. It's an important part of her biography, but it's not necessarily the first line. And the same is true with Billie here, but even more so probably. Like Billie was already a major star before this song even existed, and now she's just unquestionably a superstar.
Is it overgeneralizing, and maybe three guys sitting here aren't the ones to ask, but is there something to every generation, but every once in a while, every few years, or if you go back to, say, Alanis Morissette in the 90s, that...
Love taking it back to Alanis Morissette in the 90s, Gary.
Every once in a while, an artist comes along who just happens, again, I'm not just grouping everyone together, but a younger female artist known for lack of a better term, but moody music that's alternative and pop. And maybe there's something to younger female fans who can identify with that. And sometimes we're thinking, wow, how did this get to number one? But maybe it's not always the obvious pop hit. The alternative side of the audience likes music too.
Yeah, and I remember looking at this when we were doing something last year or the year before around the time of the Grammys about the youngest people to ever win the Album of the Year Grammy. And they're almost all women. For whatever reason, it seems like I don't know if you want to make your generalization about girls maturing faster than guys or whatever, but it seems like the pop public has an easier time taking young female artists seriously than it necessarily does with young male artists. I mean, there's exceptions to that on both sides, obviously, but when you look at these kind of these phenoms that aren't just, maybe it's because the male ones tend to get booked in as teen heartthrobs, whereas that doesn't necessarily flow the other way gender wise. But the young female artists do seem to, like you say, they come around once every 10 years or so, 10, 15 years, and they feel like they're really kind of crystallizing the moment. And, sometimes they end up, blowing up and going on to adult careers even more successful than they did as teenagers. You saw that with Taylor Swift a decade ago. And sometimes, like Alanis Morissette, it's too much too soon, and maybe they're not ready for it. Maybe they decide they don't even really want it in the first place, and they never quite get back to that same place that they were when they had their teenage breakout. But with Billie Eilish, I think it seems like, you know, again, there is no ceiling on what she could accomplish at this point. She's already at such a rarefied position at such a young age. And the fact that she's young, obviously, is an important part of her personality and her music. But it's not the defining part. And then that was also true with Lorde, which makes that an interesting comparison, that both of them seem not necessarily wise beyond their years, but they seem composed beyond their years. And they it's not hard to picture either of them, you know, still being relevant and still being essential artists well into adulthood.
Do we put okay, so looking at this, do we put Halsey in that category to some degree? Because it feels like a few years ago, you know, if you'd asked who the moody alt-pop singer-songwriter is, it would have definitely been her. Now she has made her transition probably, I guess, more fully fledged pop, and whether that's, you know, a sonic thing or she's abandoned it or whatever. I mean, is she? Do you think she goes in that same boat, or has Billie Eilish taken over that lane completely? Or, I mean, just the fact that they're going to coexist for several years, just wonder what that means her place is in this discussion.
Well, I think Halsey is probably a little bit more established on pop radio now. I think she's sort of like a can't-miss artist in a way that Billie Eilish isn't necessarily proven to be yet. Although, you know, we were talking about Nightmare here a couple podcasts ago, and that obviously didn't really take off at radio in any meaningful way. And you could even wonder if maybe, like, you know, the fact that song was a little bit more alternative, a little bit grungier, maybe that's the lane that's more occupied by Billie Eilish currently, and that, you know, maybe pop radio can play one or two, you know, sort of an underground experimental kind of pop songs, but doing a third edgy pop song from Halsey is considered a bridge too far. I don't know about that.
Makes me think of Avril Lavigne too. She was somewhere sort of in the middle. Kind of started pretty much pop with Complicated, but songs like Skater Boy, I feel like there was always kind of that element there.
I remember the middle school girls when they like wanted to have problems. Like
they wanted to have problems. They were seeking out problems.
You know, everyone feels like they, you know, they need some 3D-ness to themselves, sure. And you know, I'm not just happy all the time.
But in reality, I'm sure there's more than enough room in the pop landscape for both of them. I think you could say that maybe Halsey isn't like the newest thing on the block anymore. That's certainly a fair assertion to make, but she's also significantly older than Billie Eilish. She's already into her mid-20s. She's an adult artist. She's been
significantly older.
She's almost a decade older. That's an inarguable point, my man.
Feels like when Halsey came along, New Americana was very much pushed to alternative. She was really billed from the start as alternative, but that kind of segued pretty quickly with Closer, and ever since then, she's been pretty much straight down the middle pop.
I don't think Billie Eilish really cares to make much of a transition at all. I think she'll say, yeah, if pop wants to play me, pop can play me. If all wants to play me, all can play me. If country wants to play me, I'm sure that she's welcome there too. Well, maybe not. But you know, like she doesn't make music for radio in any meaningful way. Or at least if she does, it's pretty cleverly disguised in her music, which doesn't really seem to concede to obvious pop formatting or alternative formatting or anything like that. She and her brother make the songs that they want to make. And if radio wants to glom onto them, they're welcome to do so. But she's been pretty consistent in putting out product that seems true to her and her artistry, and that isn't necessarily geared towards any particular audience or format.
One move she did make that could be considered obviously really commercial, but again tied to who she idolized when she was even younger, bringing Justin Bieber on.
Sure.
So when you look at that, when you look at how after the first album, Lorde was working with Taylor Swift's collaborators. There does seem to be this draw that once you get this big, you might be in meetings with or labels saying, what if you work with this person? So there is that chance that commercial success brings more of a, whether it's temptation or opportunities to go more mainstream after that.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. But I think that the Bieber thing was also more organic than that maybe gives it credit for. You know, she had repeatedly stated in interviews going back to well before she was in the same sort of pop galaxy as Justin Bieber, saying like, yeah, I grew up with this guy's poster on my wall. He's one of my heroes. And so there was like a sort of wish fulfillment aspect to the Bad Guy remix. And going back to the fact that, for the single art for that, she actually used a photo of her as a, you know, a 12 or 13 year old with braces and the or Invisalign and the poster on the wall, as she so often claimed that, It didn't feel like she was trend hopping, cloud chasing, whatever you want to say. It didn't feel like she was using Bieber just to get his name on the record or just to say, hey, you'll make this a bigger hit. Why don't you come on? It was like, hey, this is incredible. Like it felt organic. Like everything she does sort of feels organic. Even if there are strings being pulled, there you don't really see them in the process. Everything that she does feels very much on brand for her and part of what she would be doing anyway if she didn't also happen to be one of the biggest stars in the world.
Yeah, I can't imagine that. I mean, yeah, to that point, I think like the Suits definitely saw that opportunity and, you know, wanted to exploit that. I mean, I think if Justin, let's say Justin Bieber weren't at his high point, but, you know, if they said, oh, you need to get Drake or The Weeknd on this song or whatever, I have a hard time thinking that she would allow that to happen. Just maybe the Bieber, like, it's obviously so organic and so natural, and I'm not sure of this, the story of exactly who reached out to whom and how all those parts came together, but... Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's just we need to get the biggest male artist on this song. It's just like, hey, you like this guy and he likes this song. You know, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, it made sense for everybody. And it gave Justin Bieber the chance to kind of seem edgy, to show that he's still cool. And then the fact that someone like Billy would have grown up idolizing him is a major cosign for him. You know, he's been around for over a decade now. He needs to kind of keep proving himself at this point, keep proving that he's still relevant, that he's still... You know, can be the heartthrob that he was when he was a teenager, and so it's sort of a win win for everybody. As it turned out, the actual song wasn't necessarily that great. The remix was maybe sort of lacking. Maybe Bieber's part wasn't as cleverly engineered as it could have been.
It was almost more just the news that it came out.
Yeah,
as opposed to
it was a good headline. Yeah. It was a fun day's worth of content. I'm sure that they're not going to break their backs promoting it from here. It already seems to have basically faded into the ether. But it was a fun moment for the two of them, and if they had timed it a little bit better, if things had maybe broken a little bit more their way, maybe it would have made the difference in them supplanting Lil Nas X number one a little bit earlier. But as it turns out, maybe the timing worked out for the best for everybody, except for Bieber maybe. But it was made right in due time.
But I feel like it almost does help that it didn't go to number one with that mm-hmm. Bieber remix, because I think the whole narrative around it would have shifted a little bit. Of course, there have been questions of, you know, could she have done it on her own and da-da-da. But I just think the fact that, I mean, to bring it back to, you know, this is a song that she and her brother made. And, you know, I mean, we've heard countless stories of people in the industry, like, you know, once the Suits or the label heads or the people try to get involved, then that's when the results fall apart. You think that you can somehow, and I think 2019 is a great year in itself to sort of make that point. You think you can always manipulate these hits and we can trust us. We know how to make a hit. And this girl and her brother made a number one hit, and you don't want to mess with that too much, I think, going forward. So that to me is a key lesson to learn, that let the creatives be the creatives.
Well, it's also the thing we talked about when Old Town Road first went to number one, after we'd already heard the Billy Ray Cyrus remix. We knew that was going to be major, and then we knew that was probably going to take it to the next level. But I think we were all glad that he made it to number one on his own, so that the narrative of that song didn't have to be, oh, well, you know, it was this cute little song, and then this big established country started to go, you know, took ownership of it and brought it to that next level that it couldn't gotten to on its own. No, it could have gotten there on its own. It did get there on its own. And so that doesn't have to be sort of an asterisk next to the song as a sort of fun, organic thing made by a teenager in his bedroom or a 20-year-old. I can't remember exactly how old Lil Nas X was when he did the song. But it's the same sort of thing as Bad Guy. Like, it's a much more fun story when it's just these kids kind of working off the grid and coming up with this major pop hit. And so the fact that both songs got to number one without the star help, even though obviously we're not comparing Billy Ray Cyrus to Justin Bieber at this point in their careers, but the fact that he was able to do it on his own, it's a huge one.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So talking Old Town Road, what's the legacy of the song going forward? We've been talking about almost nothing but that as a current hit.
I think the song's going to take a breather for a little while. I think that once the song kind of fades from the charts and officially, you know, kind of bows out of this particular cycle, I think everyone's going to need a break. I think, you know, you'll hear it some on end of year stuff, end of decade stuff. But once we get into the 2020s, think it's probably going to be a couple years before people are ready to revisit that song. I don't think you're going to hear it very much out. I don't think you're going to hear it very much on the radio. I don't think there's going to be, you know, there's certainly not going to be any more new remixes or new videos of it coming out, I don't think. But I think long term, I don't think it's going to be looked at as like a passing fancy. I don't think it's going to be looked at as a fad or a craze or anything like the Macarena, where people look back and actually kind of wince at it. I don't think that's the case. I think there was too much going on with this song, too much that made it interesting, too much that made it vital, too much that kind of intersected with other conversations we're having about pop music and genre and the music industry in general and the internet and the changing of the guard and in terms of the major stars that sort of define the marketplace at this point in time. There's too much of that all going on. The song was too important to sort of fade back into novelty. So I think long term it'll be remembered very fondly. And I also think it's still I think it's a great song. I think it's a really interesting and innovative song, and I think that eventually we'll look back at this song as being one of the definitive songs of this time period.
He does seem to have great, no matter what happens, he seems to have great perspective
yep.
about everything, tweeting congratulations to Billie Eilish and joking that he's already going to get dropped by Columbia Records now that he's not number one anymore.
Yeah, no, he will definitely remain in the culture. I think it's sort of a TBD on whether or not he's going to have the sort of hits and the sort of musical consistency and endurance to really piggyback off the success and drive to further start from here. Obviously, it's hard for anybody to follow up the longest reigning hit in Hot 100 history, but it's going to be a challenge for him. He's had other small hits, but he hasn't really been proven as a reliable, interesting, compelling artist. But he's also very young, and he's also very new to this in general. You know, even Billy is probably much more experienced than he is, and just in terms of making music. You know, he's only been doing this for a couple of years now. So he'll certainly have his chances. I think there's a lot of public goodwill towards him. And as you say, he's a great presence in Twitter and in media in general. So he's not going away. But we'll see whether this is the first, you know, the first single in a long and really important musical career, or this is just, hey man, this guy had this one great song and he knew how to promote it like hell, and we'll always remember him fondly. But he's kind of going to stay mentally compartmentalized at this point in time.
I mean, there's no way this sort of doesn't overshadow his career for a long, if not forever, time. But I mean, you hope he doesn't go down in that one hit wonder bucket. At least I personally just don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, even if he can grab a couple more top tens or something, I think that would be nice. You know, even though a 19-week number one is going to probably eat up your next three, four, five top tens before people remember that. But I think in some ways I'm really interested too to see how the legacy of the song goes forward, not just in a musical sense, but I guess in a strategic sense. I mean, talking about the promotion, the fact that, you know, I think for the first time a lot of people sort of got to understand the mechanics behind how a song sort of can work its promotion and with remixes and, you know, I mean, people looking at Billboard chart rules and how these things, you know, merge up together. And I just wonder if that in a lot of ways also becomes part of its legacy. It just even, I mean, it's like a business case study.
It's instructive.
I mean, so I'm sure there are plenty of people who are, you know, somewhere record labels trying to unpack how you did this. And I don't know if it's something that you can boil down to a science, but for me, that seems like it'll be almost in some ways the bigger legacy of this song is, you know, how did you turn this bedroom hit into this 19-week number one? I mean, and to me, the timing, of course, is everything. I almost feel like I was thinking the other day, like, if this had happened 10 years ago and, like, we had the same tools and, like, the same access, like, I bet you, like, Soulja Boy could have taken that number one record. I mean, just if you'd have taken that bedroom track, the dance challenges, put it here, got this person in the video, got this. I mean, it feels like that same kind of strategy just has become 2.0 with Lil Nas X. So I'm sure, you know, somebody's out there trying to make it a 3.0. And, you know, I mean, I think that's something that they can definitely learn and give them some re-energized hope. I mean, not only can you just make a number one or even a hit, but you can take all of these records, make all this money, you know, we'll see with Grammy season, maybe get some big recognition and some awards, definitely some year-end lists. I mean, it's not just one isolated hit, but you can make this a cultural phenomenon and keep it going forever.
That's two bedroom number ones in a row by people. As you're saying before, Trevor, labels, oftentimes they do. They are able to put the right people together for a hit. Other times it's that organic.
And the other question I thought you were going to ask to bring up from the Five Burning Questions article was I asked, you know, I set a period for an over under for when this record was going to be broken. I said, you know, I gave people a 15-year window, so August 2034. Do you think the record will be broken again by then or not? Would you go over or under for that being the next number one?
I mean, I feel like it's one of those things where, you know, the human body can only run a mile so fast at some point before, you know, it just physically can't go past that. So I feel like it's one of those things where, you know, I mean, yes, you can have a 20-week, a 21-week number one. I don't think you can have a 30-week number one. I just don't think that's more than half the year. I just don't know if the cultural forces or whatever record labels got to get together whoever has to hack iTunes for it. I just don't think that will just be allowed to some degree, not by Billboard, but just by the way the industry works, just the way the cultural forces work. I mean, I can't imagine anything that has that kind of pull for, you know, 6-7 months at a time. I mean, it would just, even with Lil Nas X, I mean, by the end of it, you know, a lot of people, as much as they appreciate it, were kind of like, okay, like, do we really need a fifth remix?
Yeah, and I think there's a couple things about this particular record that aren't being given enough credit. I think that people forget sometimes how much work went into making this a 19-week number one, how much strategy. I mean, this wasn't like an accident. It wasn't like he put the song out into the universe and then just kind of stood back as it took on a life of its own. He was actively working every step of the way. I mean, I've broken it down week by week in a timeline before, but like almost every week there was something going on with the song. There was a new video, a new remix, the 7 EP, some sort of Twitter movement. You know, there was always, he was always, you know, pushing it forward. This wasn't a song that just kind of took off and then his work was done. He was constantly promoting it. He was constantly, you know, moving it forward on his own. And I don't know if a lot of artists have the drive for that. And B, I don't know if a lot of artists have the ingenuity for that. And it was him. It wasn't really the label. I mean, I'm sure the label offered assistance and kind of, you know, facilitated a lot of it, but it was mostly him. And I just don't know if we're going to see that again anytime soon. And also, 19 weeks is a really long time. 19 weeks is a lot longer even than 16 weeks. I mean, the fact that he got – not only did he break the week, but he broke it by a 3-week margin, that's tremendous. And that's not – like that's not something to be glossed over. It wasn't like, oh, well, Despacito got to 16 weeks and then this went to 19 weeks, so naturally something else is going to get to 20. No, 19 weeks is a huge number. Like that is – you know, it's not impenetrable, but – It's a significant jump over a number that hadn't been tied even in 21 years. And now, you know, and when we saw this in the 90s with One Sweet Day, you know, it was incremental for a little while. It was, okay, we had our first 13-week number one, then we had our first 14-week number one, then we had our first 16-week number one, and then it stopped. It's not like this stuff always moves in one straight line forward. These records don't just keep getting, you know, bigger and bigger and in regular intervals. There'll be a gap at a certain point, and I think that we're about to hit that gap now. And also, you know, we've talked about this a bunch, but there wasn't – I mean, even though there was competition in the sense of a lot of big names came out with big songs, your Ed Sheeran's, your Taylor Swift's, your Post Malone's, your you know, the Drake's, and a lot of really big names were heard from, none of those songs really caught on. Not in the way that would present a traditional challenge to a traditional number one hit. And as we talked about a couple times on the podcast, the only one of those songs that really had the numbers that would have been number one in an average week was Taylor Swift's Me. But that's one song in a 19-week span. That's not a lot. So you would think that there would have been another song that would have just, you know, kind of hit escape velocity and then just sort of took off to the stratosphere, whether it was Lizzo's Truth Hurts or Khalid's Talk or The Baby Shook. One of those songs that could have just needed that one more thing to really push it, you know, to really, really push it into that next level, and it never really happened. And I don't think you're going to get to many 19-week periods in the future where none of those songs really present themselves. I think that's really unusual. So I think you combine those three things, the fact that it not only beat the record, but it roundly beat the record, that there wasn't that much high-level competition in terms of other way runaway hits, and the fact that Lil Nas X is a pretty singular artist and working a pretty singular song. I don't think this is as repeatable as some people may think it is.
Do you think it's the record for how long?
I took the over on the 15-year mark. I think it's going to be more in Mariah and Boyz II Men territory, where it's a good 2 decades plus before we see it's like again.
All right, you're talking about these songs that couldn't knock off Old Town Road during its run. It's kind of interesting how this mark is actually going backwards. So there were 7 songs that had peaked at number 2. Now it's down to 6 underneath Old Town Road.
Still a record.
A bad guy, but it could be. Could be now again tied for the record instead of having it on its own, because Senorita, so far a number 2 hit, really, really close to being number 1 this week. The way it's trending, could be our new number 1 song next week.
That's very interesting. It's not often you pencil in those Billboard records, and then you got to turn it over and erase it a little bit after that. That's something I had not yet considered. But Old Town Road's gonna, that's gonna headline the record books for a little while now. Still.
All right, Andrew. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
With going back 40 years to 1979, so the song that we're flashing back to is "My Sharona" by The Knack. Hit number one on the Hot 100 40 years ago this week. And our friends Dave and Yael Penn from Hit Songs Deconstructed are joining us with thoughts on how, four decades later, the song persists as a classic. And beyond that, how you can trace it to recent current hits, including Bad Guy, as we're going to hear, in terms of some of the compositional characteristics common to both that song and current hits. We're also going to hear Peter Griffin would be very happy. A little piece of Surfing Bird coming up. So that's all on the way to take us out, deconstructing "My Sharona" by The Knack on the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast. Dave and Yael Penn, welcome back to the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast.
Hey, Gary. Great to be back. Hey, Trevor.
Hey, there.
Talking "My Sharona," and other than it being the anniversary, Dave, of 40 years at number one this week in 1979, are you such a chart watcher that that's the reason it's been on your radar recently?
No, it's actually interesting how I came to rediscover "My Sharona." I was putting together our latest workshop a couple of months ago, and I needed to find an example of a classic hit to complement more recent hit examples to illustrate what we call the multi-section hook fest technique. And this is where every single section of the song is primed for maximum infectiousness. So I started going through the Billboard Greatest Hits of All Time Hot 100 singles, and I stumbled upon "My Sharona," which I hadn't heard in years. Yeah. And the second I put it on, it all came back to me how infectious the song really is. And, once we deconstructed it, we realized that we found the perfect classic case study of the multi-section hook fest technique in action. It's certainly one of the hookiest songs that you'll ever hear. And that's why 40 years on, we still really can't get "My Sharona" out of our heads. And the beauty of it is that while it comes across so simplistic, when you look under the hood, you really see how meticulously well-crafted it really is. So if good with you, we'll take a walk through the song and, see how it all comes together. All right. So the first section is an intro, which was and still is by far the most popular way to kick off a top 10 hit. So, for example, in the first half of 2019, 96% of all top 10 hits kicked off with an intro. However, "My Sharona's" intro is pretty lengthy compared to many of today's hits. It clocks in at 19 seconds, which is almost twice as long as the 2019 year-to-date pop average. But despite its longer length, it has absolutely no problem at all keeping the listener engaged. And as you're going to see, it also sets up some of the most important hooks that you're going to hear throughout the song. So it begins in a very atypical way compared to most hits, and that's with an infectious drum hook. But the fact that it's atypical is one of the key things that helps "My Sharona" to easily cut through airwave clutter, grab the listener's attention, and hook them in right from the get-go. Now, even though it's atypical, there are other notable hits from both yesterday and today that belong to the drum hook intro club. So are you guys up for a quick round of drum hook trivia? We got to do it. We always have to do some kind of trivia, so let's do it. So we're going to start off more recent here. This one's easy, promise. I want to see who gets it. Now, this is a competition between Gary and Trevor. Let's do it.
"Shake It Off," Taylor Swift.
You got it. Okay.
1-0 me.
Okay. Number two.
Oh my God! I know that song.
Hello.
That's "Sunflower." Yeah, "Sunflower."
There you go. We can go even a little bit more obscure. This might be a little bit harder here. Any takers?
So Gary and I are both looking pretty blank.
Rolling Stones.
That's a major hit. Rolling Stones. That's the artist for sure. Name of the song. No. Oh, no. It's gone.
Honky Tonk Women.
Yeah.
Oh, Honky Tonk Women.
All right. One more. Last one.
The tiebreaker.
Oh, yeah. That's the song that we're talking about. That's like, yeah. That's
that
that's
Marsharona?
Like, yeah, we brought it back full circle.
Yes, good. Okay.
I said the title
technically for the record, I got the answer. Like that's a roundabout answer, but it's still correct.
I said the official title.
Okay. All right. We're going to have more trivia later. So, all right. So that last one is, of course, Marsharona. But the intro doesn't stop at the drum hook. It then adds bass, followed by electric guitar, which further establishes the foundational instrumental hook groove that's heard throughout the majority of the song. So here's the full intro. Now, the foundational hook technique is also used to great avail in the hits of today. And a great recent example is the super infectious bass hook that's established right from the get-go in Bad Guy, which just hit number one on the Hot 100 40 years after Marsharona. So getting back to Marsharona, besides the infectious groove, the intro does one other important thing. It establishes the end-of-line chord progression hook that foreshadows the variations of the Sharona vocal hook that's heard in the verse sections. So as you can see, Marsharona achieves a lot in the very first section. And now the listener is totally hooked in and ready to move into the verse that follows. But one other thing that I just want to point out is that to some, the intro is also going to sound familiar, which makes it easier for the listener to connect with the song at first listen. And this is a hallmark of many hits, both from yesterday and today. So there are two aspects of the main hook that might sound familiar to very different audiences. So the first is the intro from this song. And let's see which one of you guesses this one first. Ooh. Any takers?
Oh, I guess if we had to wait that long. This is like in Jeopardy when you just hit the nobody knows.
Spencer Davis Group, Give Me Some Love in 1966.
Who? What?
So it's basically the reverse of the Marsharona hook with a similar rhythm. So Marsharona's progression goes from the root to the fifth and begins with the drums, followed by bass and guitar entering the mix. And on the flip side, Give Me Some Lovin' goes from the fifth to the root and begins with bass and guitar, followed by the drums. Now, the next one is a bit more obscure, so I really don't have high hopes of you guys guessing this one, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. You get extra credit if you do. Any guesses?
No. I gotta tap out.
Yeah. All right. Well, unless you're a classic metalhead like I am, you probably never heard Judas Priest's Cheater from their 1974 debut Rockerola. But when I heard that, I knew I heard that end-of-line chord hook somewhere before, and it's actually Judas Priest.
That sounds a lot like the hook of Marsharona, not even just similar. That's kind of the same notes, isn't it?
It's pretty much identical.
Yeah.
But even the way that it's phrased is very similar as well. Yeah. Right, so yeah. It's worth being a metalhead sometimes. Yeah. All right. moving on to verse one, it keeps the listener locked in the main groove where that was established in the intro, and now introduces Doug's infectious vocals into the mix.
Ooh, my little pretty one, pretty one. When you gonna give me some time, Sharona? Ooh, you make my motor run, my motor run. Gonna come in off of the line, Sharona.
So in addition to the main instrumental hook, there are two points where Doug repeats the same lyrics in a back-to-back manner. So you got pretty one, pretty one, and motor run, motor run. And this is something that we call the partial line repetitive vocal hook technique, and it's a great way to provide a section with an infectious spin while heightening memorability. Now, this hook technique is one of the most popular that you'll find being used in both the hits of yesterday and today. Post Malone just really took it to the next level.
Do I get extra credit, Dave, for saying that's Physical by Olivia Newton-John, the first one?
Or is that too easy? Gary, yes. Oh, you do get extra credit. I mean, that for triple credit, what year did that come out?
81.
Oh, wow. Garrett, sorry, Trevor. You got some catching up.
No, it's cool because I'll go one better. I'll say the second song was Post Malone's Better Now. Came off, I'm going to say, like a 2018 kind of hit.
So
I think that draws the score right back even. Wow, look at that.
Well, and what did it peak at on the Hot 100?
We'll give it a 1, 2, 3. I'm going to say 3.
Yeah. Not like 10 weeks at number one for Olivia Newton-John's Physical. Look what you started there.
I know. Look, I mean, we can do this forever, so we better keep going.
All right. What was I going to say? The other thing about the verse, actually, is in between those two hooky lines, we find the end-of-line hook that was first delivered by the guitar and bass in the intro that's now being doubled by Doug's time Sharona and line Sharona exclamations. And this provides these variations of the song title hook with increased emphasis. Now, following the verse, we get to what it's really all about, and that's, of course, the chorus. And, well, as I mentioned before, the intro is longer compared to most of today's hits. The chorus actually hits earlier. So My Sharona's chorus hits at 32 seconds into the song, compared to the Hot 100 Top 10 year-to-date average of 42 seconds. And what's also interesting is that, in contrast to a lot of other hits, the chorus doesn't provide the listener with a satisfying payoff right off the bat. It begins more in the way of a pre-chorus with a more driving version of the main instrumental hook, along with more animated vocals from Doug compared to the intro and verse, which further heightens tension and anticipation. And this leads to the climax at the end with the my hook, which is doubled by the guitar, bass, and drums. So this provides the hook with more punch and power while also breaking up the familiar groove that the listener has been locked into since the beginning of the song. And this is important because it primes the listener to receive the song's main vocal hook that follows. So as you can hear, we get that tension release by settling back into the song's main instrumental hook groove, along with another variation of the song title hook, this time delivered with a stutter. And this provides the hook with an infectious spin that really serves as the song's key defining moment. Now, like drum hooks, stutter hooks are also pretty uncommon. However, there are some notable songs throughout the history of popular music that belong to the stutter hook club.
Ba 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 ba
The chorus then concludes on another familiar note with the end-of-line guitar chord hook, which reminds the listener of the Time Sharona and Line Sharona end-of-line hooks that they heard in the preceding verse and instrumentally in the intro. And then following the chorus, the song heads into verse 2, which is similar to verse 1, and then into another chorus. So essentially, this sectional progression repetition further ingrains these key hooks in the listener's head. Now, to balance out the repetition and help keep the song engaging, a new song section is introduced, which is the instrumental break. But surprise, surprise, even this one is totally hooky. It features an infectious instrumental call and response hook between the newly introduced guitar chords and the main instrumental hook groove along with the guitar solo. Following the instrumental break, we go back into familiar territory with another verse and chorus, but then to break up the repetition and further heighten engagement, we're hit with another instrumental break variation. Now, this one features Burton's lengthy guitar solo, which is something that you might expect to hear in a late 70s rock hit. And while it's great, it's not really all that memorable due to the lack of repetition. So that's where the new chord progression hook comes in, which supports the solo in a memorable manner. And a great recent example of a hit that has a standout chord progression hook is Sucker's Chorus.
I'm a sucker for you.
And one other thing about Sucker's Chorus is that it features the art of the build technique that we just saw with My Sharona. It doesn't give the listener the full payoff right off the bat, and instead heightens tension and anticipation for the main payoff that comes in the second stanza. So getting back to My Sharona, following the guitar solo instrumental break, which clocks in at a very lengthy 1 minute and 38 seconds and comprises one third of the entire song, My Sharona heads back into familiar territory in the very last section, which is the outro. It features the main instrumental hook groove, which provides the infectious backbone for another variation of the Sharona title hook, this time preceded by a lengthy ooh and doubled by the end-of-line guitar hook to provide it with increased power and emphasis. So all in all, My Sharona features three distinct instrumental hooks, four end-of-line instrumental vocal combo hooks, four partial-line repetitive vocal hooks, and three main vocal hook payoffs. Now, one section of the song is left hookless, and that's why we can't get My Sharona out of our heads 40 years later. However, you still haven't really made it until you get this man's treatments. Yeah, so it's just, you know, in a nutshell, My Sharona is just an incredible song, just so hooky. And, you know, it's no wonder why it still resonates with us 40 years on.
Great how you tie it, Dave, to Bad Guy, in the sense that it feels like songs known mostly for instrumental hooks aren't in the majority. And I would think a lot of people with Bad Guy, they think of that musical part after she says, duh, that part kicks in. So sometimes,
right,
sometimes
it happens. Right, instrumental break, yeah, yeah.
And for the legacy of this song, too, I feel like you're more the classic rock expert, Dave, but as much as it was a six-week number one at the time, wasn't there some element of it being a little overhyped in terms of it got to the point where it was so overhyped there was a little bit of backlash? But here we are 40 years later celebrating it as an all-time classic.
Yeah, I heard the same thing. It's what was that other group that was totally overhyped and actually had a backlash? Moby Grape in 1967, where they released like six singles at the same time or seven singles, and it was just so hyped up. And it kind of relegated them to like a one-hit wonder. And that's kind of what happened with, you know, the Knack and My Sharona. But, you know, regardless, it is an incredible song, overhyped or not. So.
And as you always find, Dave, great songwriting is great songwriting. And because there's such a thread between the catchiness of pop songs over decades, it's once you dig in, it's never really that surprising that you can find that a song from 40 years ago and songs from today, there are so many similarities in the way they're constructed.
Yeah, I mean, listen, great craft is great craft. And, you know, the techniques and the core, you know, best practices don't really change that much. You know, what the Beatles and the Knack were doing, you know, in the 60s and 70s, you know, you still have Billy and all these other people and Post Malone doing today. You know, technology changes, sound changes, but the core best practices remain the same.
All right, Dave and Yael, we'll have you back soon. And Trevor, good luck catching up in class.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Oh, Gary, thank you. What are we going to do with you?
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.